each day is Valentine's Day.
Listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
That was T-Bone Walker. T-Bone Walker, The Hustle is On. And that song from 1950 could have been written last week. Yep. Sometimes what goes around comes around, and we've entered a new, turbulent economic and political period. So T-Bone Walker, you hit it on the dot way back in 1950. And this is Daniel Vila. This is La Voz Latina. And this year program has been on for a couple of decades on this, your radio station, because it is not paid for by the corporate elite, by big corporations. WBAI is here thanks to you, thanks to the public, and some foundations that pass on some money also. But we... personally, most of the producers here do not get paid. We're here as volunteers. And what money you do hand over to the station, believe me, it goes in just to the basics of keeping the station going. It is not for a profit institution. This is a non-profit people's station. And so we beg you, please continue supporting the WBAI. Again, Daniel Vila here, La Voz Latina. Okay, so today's program, we have various segments. We're going to move right into a segment talk. We had about a seven-minute talk with Caleb Maupin. Caleb Maupin is a reporter for RT TV News, and he is going to be making a presentation at the United Nations News Forum this coming Thursday. He and several other brothers and sisters. So we're going to be listening to Caleb tell us why he's going to the United Nations. And then we're going to move on to a very short clip, less than 2 minutes. But this is fantastic from Comrade Billy in Puerto Rico, the fifth member of the Latino La Voz Latina Collective. Billy sent us this information, which I think is fantastic. It's very short, but it's to the point. Einstein was a socialist. Many of you know it. Many of you do not know it. They don't teach you that in school, right? Okay. So not just the general, the theory of general relativity, but a whole bunch of other things political about Einstein, which they did not teach us. And then we're going to go back to Caleb Maupin. And we have this fantastic segment around 14 minutes in which he talks about socialism, but in a very modern way. I like the way he presents it. He gives you his historical examples, but he keeps things very concrete and in the present and showing how socialism is an alternative for the United States, especially in this very turbulent political, economic period that we are, a military period we are entering here. Then we're going to have another segment on the World Economic Forum. You know, the there's a migration crisis globally. And a lot of it has to do, of course, with most of it, of people looking for better jobs, moving to the industrialized countries in Europe, moving to the United States, to Canada. But what most people don't realize is that this is actually being promoted since at least 2016 and much before that also. But we're going to have a segment here in which we're going to have artificial intelligence actually read a paper written by the world and published by and on the website, incidentally, of the World Economic Forum. You could look for it. It's from 2016, in which they're pushing this massive global migration for people to leave their countries in the so-called third world, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and come to the U.S., go to Canada, go to Europe, and shake things up. And what they don't tell you, the real reason is to provide cheap labor. Cheap labor. This mass influx of immigrants that we are getting now in the United States may seem like a good thing, but actually it's going to be a hard on working people in the future, because what you're going to have is a surplus of manual and intellectual labor, so that the cost of labor is going to cheapen, and getting minimum wage rises or improvements, it's going to be very difficult in the future. That's the whole strategy, basic strategy behind this mass global migration being pushed by the World Economic Forum. Of course, one good point that Billy, I was talking with Billy this week about this in Puerto Rico, which he makes, of course, is that this global migration is also really being caused by the fact that the imperialist countries, the U.S. number one, of course, and the European imperialist countries, they've imposed poverty on Asia, Africa, and Latin America. All of these countries were once upon a time colonies of the U.S. and of the European countries. They are mostly today neo-colonies of the United States and Europe. And so these countries have governments which are corrupt. In the past, many, many, many dictatorships in Latin America, at least. Not so many dictatorships. In fact, no dictatorships right now in Latin America. They're all bourgeois, with the exception of Cuba, democratic countries. But they are countries controlled by the U.S. corporate elite, and their policies are to benefit the U.S. corporations and multinational corporations, and not the working people of those countries. And that's why people are migrating. But this migration is looked on with good eyes by the World Economic Forum. So that segment is going to be talking about that. And finally, we're going to close again with the World Economic Forum, where Kim Iverson is going to be talking about how Elon Musk blasts the World Economic Forum and why he does that, and how the World Economic Forum is just trying to impose a soft dictatorship step by step, year by year. Each year that they have these meetings in Davos, they come out with something sneaky, something which appears to be in favor of democracy, but is really imposed by the multi-billionaires of the world that meet in Davos, and they decide what's good for the planet and what is really good for them and how to get it. how to get more wealth into their pockets from our pockets into theirs, but they always phrase everything in a nice way so that it seems that it's for the interest of the masses of the people of the planet. So let's start with our talk with Caleb regarding his visit to the United Nations this coming week.
Okay, so as we had promised, we do have Caleb Maupin once again here on La Voz Latina, and so glad to have you, Caleb. How are you doing?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Fantastic, Caleb. And you know what? I was really excited to see that you're going to be going to the UN. You know, I've spoken at the UN a few times already on behalf of Puerto Rican independence, and I also saw that you're going to be visiting the UN this week, Caleb. Can you tell us a little bit what that's all about?
Sure. Well, we're going to be having a press conference at the United Nations on Thursday, sponsored by the Russian mission, because myself, representing my organization, the Center for Political Innovation, Christopher Halali, representing his organization, the Party of Communists USA, and Elizabeth Pecan, representing her organization, the American Student Union, all three of us are guests. We are invited to the World Youth Festival, sponsored by the Russian government, at the beginning of March. And we're going to be headed to Russia. And in light of the indictment of the African People's Socialist Party, we fear we could be retaliated against by the American government. You know, the charge against the Uhuru movement, they're getting ready to go to trial. It'll probably go to trial in April, is that they went to a conference in Russia. And now they're accusing them of being foreign agents, and they've been indicted. They could possibly go to jail for 15 years just for going to this conference, the anti-globalization conference in Russia. So we are going to go to Russia to the World Youth Festival, but we want to make clear to the American government that we are doing so in a completely legal way, and we want to highlight the intimidation that we are facing. So we're going to make a point at the United Nations of saying that the American government has, you know, indicted the Uhuru movement, how undemocratic this is, and how it makes us afraid to go to this international gathering where we'll be able to meet youth from all over the world. So it's going to be an important event. It'll be, you know, streamed live on the UN's, broadcast. It'll be there in the press room at the United Nations, and we just want to make clear that we're going to the World Youth Festival and that we have the right to do so and show how despicable what has happened to the Uhuru movement is. So it's going to be an important thing, and we're really honored to be there. I'm really honored that the Russian mission is willing to give us a platform to put this forward, and I'm looking forward to the event on Thursday.
That is great news. And you know what, for those people, now that you're telling us what this is all about, for those people who are unable or don't know how to manage, in any case, it's very simple. They just go on the internet and they look for the United Nations, and you look for the particular committee. Do you know the name of the committee which will be listening, giving you?
It will not be a committee. This will be a press briefing, and it'll be in the press briefing room after the noon briefing called by Stefan Dujarric. Every day the UN does a noon briefing with Stefan Dujarric, who's the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General. Immediately afterwards, the Russian mission will be, you know, utilizing the press room to give us that platform, to give us, you know, the opportunity to speak to the media about our planned trip to Russia.
So, folks, just get on the internet and look for the news briefing or news or information from the UN. But for those who have difficulty or who may be working or for whatever reason will not be able to tune in, we will be having that information, Caleb, next week then on La Voz Latina. We'll be rebroadcasting your words and the words of several of the other speakers at the United Nations, okay? Just so that you know.
Because, yeah, very good.
Yeah, we have to do this. You know why? Because this is a matter of, frankly, our civil liberties in this country are really being threatened. And, you know, I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump, and neither are you. But it's interesting how under the name of destroying Donald Trump and destroying right-wing, politically right-wing politicians, Democrats who are not anymore to the left anyway, are using this as an excuse to destroy freedom of information in this country and persecute people, political leaders. This has not happened since the 1970s, this vicious type of attack like they did against Uhuru. And even the incident, the Tucker Carlson just went to Russia, interviewed Putin. Now, a journalist has that right. And in fact, Fidel Castro was interviewed in the 1980s or 90s also by bourgeois journalists. And there was no big deal. So we're losing our freedoms now. And I'm so glad that you're going to be going before the UN and denouncing this situation.
Yes. The fact that Tucker Carlson was able to interview Putin, I think that was a great thing. And that, you know, interviewing heads of state from whatever country is just kind of normal. It's a normal, and especially if there's a country that our government is at odds with, there used to be an understanding that it was the media's responsibility to interview them, right? If the USA is at odds with Russia, then, you know, it was the duty of a responsible journalist to go interview Russia and get their side of the story. That's what the press is supposed to do. And when I see liberals calling for Tucker Carlson to be prosecuted and thrown in jail just for doing an interview with Putin, I'm just shocked. And to be fair, it wasn't a softball interview by any means. I mean, he asked him tough questions. He got him talking. And the fact that they want to criminalize this, I mean, this is like during the Bush years, you know? During the Bush years, you were with Bush or you were with the terrorists, you were a traitor. That was the Fox News line. That's right. The liberals' line now. The liberals right. are the new neocons, right? With us or against us. Oh, you can't talk to Putin. You can't have another viewpoint or else you're with the enemy. You need to be thrown in jail. It's the response to the Tucker Carlson interview that I've seen from the what you like to call the Mickey Mouse left is just utterly horrifying to me. And it reinforces my position that while we can be critical of Donald Trump and such, that the movement against Trump is not coming from a good place. And many Americans support Donald Trump for good reasons, because they see him as at odds with the political establishment that's driving down our living standards and leading us to war.
Okay, Caleb Maupin, and then once more, more or less the time at which this press briefing will take place at the United Nations will be?
It'll be at noon on Thursday. It'll be, you know, there'll be the noon press briefing, and then it'll be immediately afterwards we'll have ours. So it'll be around noon on Thursday, February 15th.
Okay, yeah. And for those listeners who do not know Caleb, we're going to be putting some 10 or 15 minutes of Caleb's recent talk on Marxism, which was, I believe it was in, was it Arizona or Utah? I forgot what state you were. Oregon. Was it in Oregon, right? I believe.
Yeah,
you were,
Oregon.
Yeah. Oregon.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for those listeners who do not know you, stick around just 10 or 15 more minutes, and you're going to hear what the political views of Caleb Maupin are on Marxism, and I think we all learn something every time we listen to Caleb. Caleb, warm embrace, and we'll catch you hopefully in a week and a half after the that press briefing.
All right. Sounds good. And talk to you soon.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's have this 1.5-minute segment on Einstein being a socialist.
Five reasons Albert Einstein was a socialist. These are arguments that he laid out in an article called Why Socialism in 1949. Number one, he says capitalism's profit motive means human needs go unmet to satisfy human greed. Number two, he says the individual and society form a symbiotic relationship, and a healthy society needs a healthy individual, and a healthy individual needs a healthy society. Capitalism primarily rewards individual success, often at the expense of the collective welfare. Number three says science is amoral. He looks at the core tenets of socialism as ethical ideals and capitalism as an unethical ideal. And so he believed under capitalism, science would be exploited, used to enslave humankind, and eventually destroy us. Number four, he argues that transitioning to socialism was imperative to avoid nuclear Armageddon and ecological catastrophe. Number five, he argues that capitalism undermines democracy by concentrating wealth into the hands of a few economic elite. And then the ultra-rich use their money to lobby the government to represent their interests, and that they're also able to control our education system and media, preventing free thought.
All right, Daniel Vila here. This is La Voz Latina, continuing with the program. We're now going to move on from Einstein back to Caleb Maupin, who had a fantastic event recently, the Center for Political Innovation in Oregon. And he talks at very sharp points here about what Marxism is all about.
The Marxism is the opposite of that. Marxism is a celebration of human creativity. Frederick Engels. He said, the animal merely uses its environment and brings about changes in it simply by its presence. But man, by his changes, makes it serve his ends, masters it. And this is the final distinction between man and other animals. And it is labor that brings about this distinction. What's he saying there? He's saying that ants have been making their ant farms the same way for thousands of years. Beavers have been making their beaver dams the same way for thousands of years. But in just 8,000 years, human beings have gone from hunter-gatherers in the woods to space travel and iPhones, and we are constantly reinventing our relationship with our environment. We are constantly expanding our population, expanding our living standard, providing a more comfortable life. And that this is what makes human beings unique, is that we are constantly reinventing our relationship with nature to build a better life. And no other species that we're aware of anywhere in the universe is capable of doing what human beings are doing, are capable of doing. This is a godlike creative power that other species do not have. And that's something to celebrate. And that's something to be optimistic about. And Marxism teaches us that hunter-gatherer civilization was around for a long time, but we got too good at hunter-gatherer civilization. With our sticks and rocks, we were killing animals pretty effectively. With our ability to track and plants grow, our ability to gather fruits and nuts, we got good at it, so there was a scarcity. So we reinvented our relationship with nature, and we started growing our own crops and domesticating animals. We reinvented our relationship to get to a higher mode. And feudalism was an outmoded system. So, again, we had another social revolution to get us to a higher mode of existence so we could create and build better things. And Marxism has us understanding what the problem that we're in right now is. Because we need to be very clear about what is driving the crisis. This is one thing that it's basic Marxism. If you read old pamphlets from the 1930s, if you ask Anna Louise Strong or William Z. Foster or Huey Long or even Fred Hampton, they would tell you this in a heartbeat. They knew this stuff. They knew it like the back of their hand. But no one talks this way anymore, except for the Center for Political Innovation. We're the only ones that talk about this. The communist parties around the world that make up the World Anti-Imperialist Platform, they say in their documents that the crisis facing society is a crisis of overproduction. That's what it is, and it's pretty basic, which is that the capitalist is constantly trying to produce as many goods as he possibly can and pay the worker as little as he possibly can in the process of doing it. And then the worker doesn't have enough to buy back what he produces. And in a rational society, self-driving cars would be a great thing, because this job called driving wouldn't be necessary and human labor would be much more productive. But in capitalism, self-driving cars would lead to, as Andrew Yang put it, riots in the streets. It would be a society-wide crisis. And the fact that we're just a couple years away from self-driving cars is hanging over our economy as a curse. This isn't rational. In systems of the past, you've all heard me say it before, people were homeless because there wasn't enough housing. Only under capitalism are people homeless because there is too much housing. Systems of the past, people were hungry because there wasn't enough food. But only under capitalism are people hungry because there is too much food. The little boy says to his father, "Why is it so cold?" He says, "Because I lost my job at the coal mine." He says, "Why did you lose your job at the coal mine?" He says, "I got laid off." And he says, "Why did you get laid off from your job at the coal mine?" He says, "Because there's too much coal." That's capitalism. That's the problem with capitalism. And the artificial intelligence computer revolution, the great dynamic breakthroughs in human intelligence that we've created, they have outstripped the narrow limits and restraints of the capitalist system. Human creativity and human ability to reinvent our relationship with Mother Nature, to strive for a higher and more efficient mode of production, is no longer able to fit into the narrow restraints of an economy where profit for private owners defines production. And that is what is driving the crisis that is leading to dropping living standards around here. That is what is causing the crisis of global migration. That is what is causing the capitalists of the United States to become more aggressive and push for a new world war around the world. That is what is causing the capitalists of the United States to fight with each other like they've never fought before in generations. It's all rooted in this problem of overproduction and the tendency of the falling rate of profit. And the answer isn't degrowth. The answer isn't to go backward. The answer isn't to say there's something inherently wrong with human progress. The answer is to say that we need to liberate the creativity of the next generation from the artificial restrictions and the narrow restraints of the profit system. One thing that we see a lot of now is frustrated, creative youth. Young people, young men, young women, who know that they're capable of doing something great. There's probably a young person right now sweeping the floor at McDonald's or doing some other job where they're miserable, and they're saying to themselves, I'm miserable because I know I could be doing something beautiful right now. I could be designing something. I could be studying engineering. I could be studying science. I have something to contribute. But all my society has given me is a low-wage, short-term service sector job. It's given me a phone to dazzle me. It's legalized all kinds of drugs that I can use and screw myself up with. And my potential is not being utilized.
Exactly.
And that is a frustration that so many young people have in this country right now. They say young people are lazy. When people are 19 years old, 20 years old, 22, 23, that's when they want to go out and do things.
Yep.
But because some boss can't make a profit hiring them to do it, they don't get to do it.
Exactly.
And they exist in this state of frustration, going, I'm capable of something more. I have potential inside of me, and my society isn't letting me get it out. And that feeling is all over this country. And if you want to talk about all the problems that we've got with opioids and suicide and shooters and all of that, you look at that frustrated creativity.
Exactly.
When people want to go build and create and build into the future and they're told, no, no, just go the other way. It's the worst feeling in the world.
Amen.
I'm a little older now. I'm not officially a youth anymore. Did you know that? I'm going to be 36 in a few days. And I'm not officially a youth anymore, but I know what it's like to be a frustrated, creative young person. And that's how I found out about this guy. So, I was a frustrated, creative teenager in Ohio. I was 13, 14 years old. And I was bored. And so I got on the internet. And I thought that I would look and see if in the little town in Ohio that I grew up in, it's called Orrville. It's where Smucker's Jelly comes from. You can look it up, right? Home of Bobby Knight, the basketball coach. That's the celebrity that we claim. I'm from Orrville, Ohio. And I just thought I would Google on the internet to see if there had ever been another communist from Orrville, Ohio. And I thought, you know, has there ever been anyone in the history of my little town of 10,000 people who is a communist? And I Googled and I found out about Carl Geiser. And that's this man, Carl Geiser. And Carl Geiser was born in Orrville, Ohio. And he went to Orrville High School, and he was a pretty high-achieving student, so he went to Cleveland State University, and he studied electrical engineering. And he graduated, and he became an electrical engineer. But the United States was having, at that point, a Great Depression. There weren't many jobs for electrical engineers. But there was another country where there were a lot of jobs for electrical engineers. And that was the Soviet Union. And he went over to the Soviet Union to help Stalin set up those new hydroelectrical power plants that they were building and help electrify parts of the country that had never had it before. And he was over there in the Soviet Union building and constructing, and he was blown away by what he saw. And he came back to the United States from the Soviet Union, and he joined the Communist Party of the United States of America. Carl Geiser joined the Communist Party. It's a guy from my town, because he saw what socialism was achieving. A lot of people joined the Communist Party back in that time, right? I mean, there wasn't something, he was the only one to have done that. But what made Carl Geiser unique, the reason he's got a Wikipedia page and he's, you know, remembered, is Carl Geiser signed up to join the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Woo!
The Spanish Republic. The communists of Spain called for their comrades around the world to come and volunteer to fight fascism in Spain. And so thousands of young American men went to Spain and fought. And Carl Geiser was actually taken prisoner. And he was a prisoner of war in fascist Spain. And he almost died. If they had found out what his rank actually was, they would have shot him. But his comrades concealed his rank and did not reveal how high up he was, so they didn't execute him. And eventually Roosevelt got him traded back to the United States in a prisoner exchange. And he came back to the United States. And he's a hero of the Spanish Civil War, a leader of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. When you think about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, that points to an aspect of our movement that it's really important to understand. There's a famous writer named Sherwood Anderson. You ever heard of Sherwood Anderson? He wrote Winesburg, Ohio. He was a novelist. And at one point, Sherwood Anderson was asked, what's the difference between a socialist and a communist? What's the difference? And he said, I don't know the technical difference, but it seems to me like the communists, they're the ones who mean it. And what he was pointing to was the fact that when we do something, we really do it. In the early 1930s, the understanding was that the social democrats and the reformists, the sellout leaders who had sold out the revolution in Germany, that were leading workers to oppose the Soviet Union in the name of socialism, that they were the main threat, and it was necessary to expose the social democrats and the reformists. And so when that was the line of the Communist International, we didn't just half-ass oppose the social democrats. We didn't just sort of oppose the social democrats. We went all in. We really opposed the social democrats because we understood that that was what was necessary. And so all over the world, communists went into class-against-class mode to expose the social democrats and build a united front from below because we understood that that was the correct tactic. And then we know that after the rise of Hitler, and as the situation changed, the line changed, and it became correct to align with the social democrats in a united front against fascism. And when that line changed, we didn't just half-ass align with them against fascism. What did we do? We built the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and went and fought in Spain. We had the Battle of Cable Street in London. We built huge anti-fascist mobilizations. We are the reason Roosevelt won the 1936 presidential election. Yeah. When we do something, we do it hard. We do it hard. There was a labor leader who once remarked, he said, if it's 3 a.m. at your labor union hall and there's 2 guys running the mimeograph machine, you can bet at least one of them is a communist. And the people who criticize our movement, right, this is a really common critique from Trotskyites, is they'll say, well, they zigzag, you know, they're always reversing themselves. You know, they do this and then they do that. Yeah, if the situation changes in 24 hours, the tactics must also change in 24 hours. And sometimes what's correct on Monday is not correct on Tuesday, and it's not correct on Wednesday, and you have to change your tactics. And when you're as dedicated as we are, and when you never half-ass these things, when you take it very seriously, when you are fully committed to achieving what we aim to achieve, it can look a little strange to people who don't get it. They can go, well, one day you're running this way, and the next day you're running this way. Yes, and every way that we run, we're running hard because we understand that it's necessary and that it must be done. And that brings me to a story or a bit of wisdom that was passed down to me. You know, we can be critical of different figures, but Sam Marcy, an important leader of communism in the post-war years, he would often talk about how at the anti-war protests that happened during the 1960s, where you'd have hundreds of thousands of people marching against the Vietnam War, there'd be these beautiful puppets that they would build. Mm-hmm. They'd have puppets of, you know, Richard Nixon with his money or whatever. They'd have puppets of the heroic Vietnamese people fighting for their liberation, these beautiful puppets. Mm-hmm. That there were whole communities of people, and they weren't members of any communist group, but they were against the Vietnam War and had a general leftist anti-imperialist view, and they made it their mission that when there was a big anti-war rally, they would come together and they would make these beautiful works of art mm-hmm. as their contribution to opposing the war in Vietnam. And there were whole communities that built these puppets. It was their project, their way of being creative, of building community and coming together. And there were couples who met each other through the process of making those puppets. And a couple years later, they were there making the puppets with their little kids that they had just had. And there were whole communities of people, and they made it their mission. This is something that we can do. Imperialism is the enemy of humanity. The Vietnam War is horrible, and this is something we can do. We have a 9-to-5 job, we have a regular life, but this is something that we can do. And we can do it together, and we can bond, and that's beautiful. And what Sam Marcy would tell his followers is that that community that built those puppets, that's 1,000 times more valuable than some kid who thinks he's Lenin. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. A community like that has longevity. People are doing that their whole life, and they're taking on a contribution. And that you know, if you've been doing this as long as I have, which is, you know, not that long, relatively speaking, but you realize there are some people who come around, and they see that they don't get the immediate result that they want. They see that they don't fulfill their dictator fantasy that they have. They see that this isn't exactly the way they want to resolve their parental issues or whatever. And then they go away after a year. For a year, they know more than everybody. No one knows anything better. They can debate everybody, but they're gone. But those people who came together to build the puppets and build community around it and learn to work together, they keep going. Mm-hmm. And generation after generation, year after year, they build those puppets. And that is what we need to build with the Center for Political Innovation. We need a network of people who are committed to opposing imperialism, who learn to trust each other and rely on each other and carry out operations, build some beautiful puppets, some beautiful artwork, put on beautiful conferences, and keep this movement alive. That is what we need to build. We need a network of people who love each other and trust each other and can work together and can serve the purpose of representing the anti-imperialist movement in America. That is what we need. And that is what I want us to build with the Center for Political Innovation.
Okay, Camarada Caleb. So let's move on to, as we said at the beginning, the World Economic Forum is really pushing this matter of mass global migration from the third world to the developed world to the industrialized world. Let's check it out. This paper from 2016 says it all.
Is immigration good or bad? Some argue that immigrants flood across borders, steal jobs, are a burden on taxpayers, and threaten indigenous culture. Others say the opposite, that immigration boosts economic growth, meets skill shortages, and helps create a more dynamic society. Evidence clearly shows that immigrants provide significant economic benefits. However, there are local and short-term economic and social costs. As with debates on trade, where protectionist instincts tend to overwhelm the longer-term need for more open societies, the core role that immigrants play in economic development is often overwhelmed by defensive measures to keep immigrants out. A solution needs to be found through policies that allow the benefits to compensate for the losses. Around the world, there are an estimated 230 million migrants, making up about 3% of the global population. This share has not changed much in the past 100 years. But as the world's population has quadrupled, so too has the number of migrants. And since the early 1900s, the number of countries has increased from 50 to over 200. More borders mean more migrants. But the global annual flow of around 15 million migrants most fit into one of four categories: economic, 6 million, student, 4 million, family, 2 million, and refugee, asylum, 3 million. There are about 20 million officially recognized refugees worldwide, with 86% of them hosted by neighboring countries, up from 70% 10 years ago. In the US, over a third of documented immigrants are skilled. Similar trends exist in Europe. These percentages reflect the needs of those economies. Governments that are more open to immigration assist their country's businesses, which become more agile, adaptive, and profitable in the war for talent. Governments in turn receive more revenue, and citizens thrive on the dynamism that highly skilled migrants bring. Yet it is not only higher skilled migrants who are vital. In the USA and elsewhere, unskilled immigrants are an essential part of the construction, agriculture, and services sector. If immigrants play such a vital role, why is there so much concern? Some believe that immigrants take jobs and destroy economies. Evidence proves this wrong. In the United States, immigrants have been founders of companies such as Google, Intel, PayPal, eBay, and Yahoo. In fact, skilled immigrants account for over half of Silicon Valley startups and over half of patents, even though they make up less than 15% of the population. There have been three times as many immigrant Nobel laureates, National Academy of Science members, an Academy Award film directors than the immigrant share of the population would predict. Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco concluded that immigrants expand the economy's productive capacity by stimulating investment and promoting specialization, which produces efficiency gains and boosts income per worker. Research on the net fiscal impact of immigration shows that immigrants contribute significantly more in taxes than the benefits and services they receive in return. According to the World Bank, increasing immigration by a margin equal to 3% of the workforce in developed countries would generate global economic gains of $356 billion. Some economists predict that if borders were completely open and workers were allowed to go where they pleased, it would produce gains as high as $39 trillion for the world economy over 25 years. In the future, it will become even more imperative to ensure a strong labor supply augmented by foreign workers. Globally, the population is aging. There were only 14 million people over the age of 80 living in 1950. There are well over 100 million today, and current projections indicate there will be nearly 400 million people over 80 by 2050. With fertility collapsing to below replacement levels in all regions except Africa, experts are predicting rapidly rising dependency ratios and a decline in the OECD workforce from around 800 million to close to 600 million by 2050. The problem is particularly acute in North America, Europe, and Japan. There are, however, legitimate concerns about large-scale migration. The possibility of social dislocation is real. Just like globalization, a strong force for good in the world, the positive aspects are diffuse and often intangible, while the negative aspects bite hard for a small group of people. Yes, those negative aspects must be managed. But that management must come with the recognition that migration has always been one of the most important drivers of human progress and dynamism. Immigration is good. And in the age of globalization, barriers to migration pose a threat to economic growth and sustainability. Free migration, like totally free trade, remains a utopian prospect, even though within regions, such as Europe, this has proved workable. As John Stuart Mill forcefully argued, we need to ensure that the local and short-term social costs of immigration do not detract from their role as one of the primary sources of progress. Author Ian Golden is director of the Oxford Martin School and professor of globalization and development at the University of Oxford. This article draws on his book Exceptional People, How Migration Shaped Our World and Will Define Our Future, co-authored with Jeffrey Cameron and Meera Balarajan and published by Princeton University Press. Twitter, at @OxMartinSchool. He is participating in the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos.
And that document there, it's actually read, is published, and is on the website of the World Economic Forum. We're going to close now with this segment with Kim Iverson, who is going to be talking about the nasty little moves being taken by the World Economic Forum more recently to expand their ever-growing control over the human species.
What's on your radar?
Well, you may have been hearing the term ESG lately. Last Saturday, Elon Musk tweeted, "I'm increasingly convinced that corporate ESG is the devil incarnate." People who follow the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum, such as Glenn Beck, often warn against it and are even encouraging legislation to stop it from being used. But it isn't just those who are against ESG talking about it. You may have seen it in headlines on Bloomberg, MarketWatch, or Forbes. So what is it? Well, ESG stands for Environment, Social, and Corporate Governance. It's similar to a credit score, except rather than being based around a company's revenue and history of paying back debts, the ESG score is centered around sustainability and ethics. It's currently only given to corporations, but I think it's easy to imagine a future where the score is assigned to individuals as well. Now, the system was set up as a way to let investors, quote unquote, invest responsibly. Many people pride themselves on buying only sustainable products and purchasing from ethical companies. So an ESG score, which is widely used by many investment and fund management firms, makes it easy to determine which companies these are. Now you can invest your money and feel good too. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is the system is subjective to whomever decides what ethical is. Though many people believe the ESG score is about climate change and the environment, the truth is the social and governance aspects of the score have just as much weight, sometimes even more, than a company's environmental impact. So the E obviously stands for environment. That's carbon footprint, pollution, and waste. The S stands for social, which judges things such as how well a company embraces social justice and how diverse a company is. The G stands for governance. Does the company embrace things like a diversity board and who is in charge? Those sound nice enough, except this is just a small list of what goes under each category and the people deciding what is or isn't ethical, like in most Silicon Valley-based companies, are clearly liberal elites. For example, Tesla, a company that makes electric vehicles, has a moderate to moderately poor score. How can this be? Think whatever you want about Elon Musk, there's no doubt his car company has been a game changer for the environment. Yet somehow, out of the five U.S.-based automotive companies, companies like Ford, which make gas-guzzling trucks, Tesla's ESG score is the worst. Why is that? Well, because it turns out what liberal elites think about Elon Musk seems to matter. The scoring system takes into account his eclectic personality, his tendency to tweet whatever he wants, his views on COVID and his libertarian politics. Try to make sense of this. Lockheed Martin, a company that produces weapons bringing death and destruction upon the planet, has a higher social responsibility score than Tesla. Why is that? Sorry, I don't mean higher. They have a better social responsibility score. It's actually the lower the score, the better it is. So theirs is actually better than Tesla's. Well, it's because ESG scores are based on what neoliberal elites consider to be moral and good. It's good to supply weapons to our so-called friends. They use them to kill bad guys. Never mind the fact that they also kill children. But it's bad to criticize COVID lockdown policies. Never mind the fact you've arguably done more to advance a greener planet, make space travel cheaper, and bring internet to all than any government or organization on Earth. The score is political. So the company reigning at the very top of the ESG scoring list is, believe it or not, Bill Gates founded Microsoft. Are we surprised? So ESG scores determine how much and how easy it is for a company to secure funds and investments. So it's important to have a good score. The better the score, the greater the cash flow. It's why we're seeing companies go woke by regurgitating slogans like Black Lives Matter while hypocritically using prison labor. It's why companies refuse to do business with controversial people and businesses, like when Parler suddenly was dropped from Amazon and Apple. Perhaps it's why GoFundMe dropped the trucker convoy. Despite people thinking these companies make these moves out of some sort of moral signaling, the reality is that many companies don't want to harm their ability to attract investors. They feel forced to make these sort of moves. But who's forcing them? Who's in control of these scores? The people deciding whether or not you are moral and good matters. And I think it's easy to see why this type of moral scoring system can be easily abused. One might think the system is a good idea. It just needs tweaking. But any sort of score that directly ties cash flow to morals and ethics is ripe for abuse. The scores can not only change on a whim based on what the latest woke fad is, but based on what benefits the people in charge. Do we really want neoliberal elites to have the power to compel a company to completely change its ethos in order to raise their scores? This has massive implications for society. Companies are modifying their behavior to ingratiate themselves with those in power. They're changing their slogans and advertisements. They're censoring content. They're firing controversial people. Speak up, you might lose your job because you're bad for the company's ESG score. Here's another example. 10 years ago, Disney's ESG score was considered one of the worst. Now, with all the changes they've made to be more inclusive, such as the commitment to make half of all characters from the LGBTQI+ community, even though they represent only a fraction of the greater population, and made moves to rid themselves, such as right-winger Gina Carino, their score is one of the best. It's right up there with Microsoft. Though the scores haven't been used yet on individuals, we've seen some semblance of it already happening unofficially. It's what cancel culture is based on, but it's become more than just Twitter mobs coming after people. We've seen individuals banned from using social media and services like PayPal and GoFundMe refusing to send payouts to controversial people. They're not doing this because they're morally agreeing with it. They're doing it for their bottom line. Social credit systems are already being implemented in China, where good behavior gets rewarded and bad behavior results in societal shunning. ESG scores are the corporate form of this. Even if it never reaches the individual level, the impact it's having on companies ultimately affects us all. It affects which companies survive, what messages companies convey, what content we can consume, and whether or not you have a job. So if what you're doing says, if what you're doing or saying goes against neoliberal elites, you could find your company going out of business or you yourself without a job. I'm just curious if you guys, Robbie and Ryan, have you guys heard of ESG scores? This has kind of been making the social media round since Elon kind of came out and said, this is terrible. Obviously, Glenn Beck's been talking about it a lot because it is discussed quite a bit in the World Economic Forum and by Klaus Schwab as the mechanism of the future to kind of push companies and society in the direction that they want. But, you know, obviously, if you're going to base a score off of morality, who gets to decide what the morality is?
Yeah, how do they factor that in? Like, let's say he tweets something that somebody doesn't like. How, like, what's the mechanism for that to be factored into
Well,
a score?
Like credit scores, it's not exactly transparent. So we really don't know what does affect a company's score as much. There are some things that are obvious, and they get consultants, and consultants will help them figure that out. So, for example, if you add recycling bins, you know, like when Disney decided to add recycling bins to their parks, that, of course, raised their score. But so there are some obvious things, but then there are things that are not as obvious. When it comes to environment, it's a bit more obvious. When it comes to social, it's not as obvious. And when it comes to governance, it's not as obvious as well, because they could just not like your CEO and decide, well, then you get a lower score. It's more of just societal perception, and it is based on what the neoliberals believe to be good and bad.
Yeah,
Well, Tesla's gotten sued for race relations in there.
I know about this, right. So I'm just Googling around. The Motley Fool says... Yeah, it looks like it's incredibly political to me. Like it would be bordering on arbitrary. Not so much for the criteria you just mentioned, Kim. Like, you know, if you for environmental adding environmentally friendly options, if that's relevant to your industry, that seems maybe a little less political. But for their governance score, they consider the composition of the board in terms of diversity and independence. Executive compensation, business ethics, a lot of things that sound exactly like you described, Kim. Like it could just be like what makes liberal elites happy. Is this woke enough?
Yeah, because you can interpret ethics however you want, right? I mean, so it depends on who's in charge of the scoring system that gets to decide what is ethical, what isn't ethical, what is good social governance, what isn't good social governance. So now this system has been implemented for a while. It's been in use it was developed decades ago. It's been more prominently in use for at least 10 years, definitely in the early, 2010, 2011, 2012 is when it really started to take hold. And it's become much more prominent now. Pretty much every investment fund firm, money management firm uses these ESG scores. So
that's what I'd want to know. If they use them, they probably think they're valuable, right? Do investors, make more of a return on their investment if they invest in companies? Do companies that have higher or lower, whatever, better ESG scores make more money for the investors than other companies? They'd probably start ignoring them, or maybe they make more money pretending to care about them because it makes woke customers or something happy. I don't know.
It's more like putting lipstick on a pig. It's not exactly, it's like, oh, this just makes you feel good as an investor. You want to invest in companies that are, quote unquote, socially conscious or responsible or environmentally friendly. And so it's not really, a lot of these companies aren't. Actually, I mean, Lockheed Martin, why do they have a better score than Tesla? Somebody explain that. But it's more about they do little things to kind of boost their score slightly, like Disney. And it just makes investors feel better, but it's not necessary. So, yes, there's more money that flows in because if you are managing money, and your investors want to invest
But that's what I'm asking. That's what I'm wondering. Do investors see it as valuable? Do they say, oh, this company has a better ESG rating, so we should want to invest in this one because this is going to make us more money? Do they see it that way is what I wonder.
I don't think it's about making more money because that company is going to be more profitable. It's more like the investors, the people that are giving them the money, want to feel good about their investments.
Right, and they are often political entities themselves.
Right.
So let's say it's a city. Mm-hmm. So politicians are the ones who are investing the pension fund for the city. Or if it's a teacher's union or a firefighter's union, you would have people who are saying, like, we should make sure that our investments are ethical. And then the companies and then the investment managers then come up with ways to say, okay, well, these are the same way that you had a lot of climate activists in colleges telling their endowments, we don't want you investing in oil companies.
We want you to be, LEED certified or whatever that I remember that was a big deal.
Right. And so then you have money managers who create products for that. It wouldn't be surprising that the money managers don't actually care. And are creating like pretty much arbitrary stuff. Oh, you want good investments? These are good. Mm-hmm. But I also think I think there's some fairness to saying, like, if you've had a ton of like settlements around harassment and racism in your workplace, that there might be some consumers who want to take that into account, or some investors that want to take that into account when they're deciding whether not to invest. So I think, because from a kind of socialist perspective, it's like, look, you've already told socialists that they can't democratically control how investment is done in society.
I have told them that.
Right, you told them that. Look, but you're free to make your own choices about how investments are made. And then if they organize and start directing it, so, well, not like that. Mm-hmm. So but I think Kim's right that she's flagged like a lot of flaws in how this is done. But I think the principle, if you're not going to allow democratic control of capital investment, then people still do have a right to organize around the idea of how you invest money in society.
Sure, but they definitely have a right. We
have a right to say the way you're doing it is kind of silly.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, this is putting a score. It's almost like putting a scarlet letter on somebody who is bad, right? Because if you have a bad score, then it's like you're getting a scarlet letter. So, I mean, yes, I understand the principle of it that, okay, I would like to know which companies are socially responsible and which ones I want to, you know, which ice cream do I want to buy? Do I want to buy Ben and Jerry's or do I want to buy, you know, some other company that maybe doesn't share the same values as I do, right? We have that ability to make those choices as a consumer, as an individual, of course. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that these ESG scores are not about the people organizing. This is about neoliberal elites organizing, and they decide these scores. And then they're telling us this is who is good and who is bad.
Often it's people organizing, but then the people's organizing work is being co-opted and channeled by those neoliberal elites, which is story of our lives.
All right, thank you, Kim. Tomorrow on Rising, journalist Manny Marotta will be here to break down the latest on the Russia-Ukraine war.
And Layla Dalton, the Starbucks union leader who was recently fired by the company, will be with us to discuss her experience and her efforts to unionize.
Be sure to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And be sure to check out our podcast. We've got podcasts wherever podcasts are available. So be sure to share and subscribe that as well. And also find us on TikTok. I think we're everywhere now, right? We're like TikTok, podcasts.
Everywhere. Can't avoid us.
You cannot avoid us. You cannot escape.
You could suspend us.
Please don't try. For now, we're everywhere. We're going to get ourselves in trouble again. We'll try not to do that. And we'll see you all next time.
Bye-bye.
WBAI, La Voz Latina here, Daniel Vila. Okay, Kim Iverson, that's a sharp. All of her presentations on YouTube, they're just so fantastic. She goes to the point and very clear, very sharp. So again, this is La Voz Latina on WBAI. We hope you enjoyed the program. Hope it was informative. It was definitely informative for me. I learn each week when I get the program together. I learn a lot. So we hope to catch you again next Sunday at midnight. Warm embrace.
Extinction Diaries. An alarming World Wildlife Fund for Nature study revealed that every human on Earth is breathing, drinking, and eating nearly 2,000 plastic particles each week, the equivalent of a credit card. The Plymouth University study says 700 or more marine species are now threatened with extinction from the 165 million tons of plastic in the sea, 25 times heavier than the Great Pyramid. Plastics break down by sunlight, water, and wind into particles that never truly go away. It is literally everywhere. Even small samples of seawater or beach sand from the Arctic to the Antarctic contain plastic. Studies show that there are 9,000 pieces of plastic per square kilometer of water, and ocean plastic will weigh more than all of the fish in the oceans by 2050. Plastic is in the entire food chain, and invisible microplastics to garbage bags and larger are killing ocean life. In 2019 alone, hundreds of whales and dolphins washed up dead by plastic. The situation is critical. Plastic is leading to extinction and must be illegal. The solution from each of us is clear. Clear as water. My name is Mahia Soul, and this is a Small World Radio production.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, February 14th at 7 p.m. The LSB expects to be populating subcommittees and task forces at both the national and the local board level. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, February 14th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service and is accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also gain access by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. The meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. It's 995, like WBAI's frequency. So it's 995-995-99. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we certainly need you to. Thank you.